Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Tonight we're very pleased to welcome to the store Charlie Burrell and Mitch Handelsman. In 1949, Charlie Burrell moved to Denver from Detroit, where he studied music and served in the Navy. After playing music for several years, he joined the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra before returning to Denver in the mid-1960s. He retired from the Colorado Symphony Orchestra in 1999. And there's a whole lot more, but you'll have to read the book for all that. Mitch Handelsman is an award-winning professor of psychology and a CU President's Teaching Scholar at the University of Colorado, Denver. Tonight, they join us to discuss and sign the new book, The Life of Charlie Burrell, Breaking the Color Barrier in Classical Music. Please join me in welcoming Charlie Burrell and Mitch Handelsman.
Thank each and every one of you. This has been a pleasure. And I know you're expecting great words of wisdom, but I have none. I'd like to first introduce my son and his son, three generations of Charlie Burrells right now, and it's because of he, my son, that I'm here. If it hadn't been for him, I wouldn't be here. So give him a nice little round of applause. And you know, it's funny because I had no idea before this all happened. I had so many friends, but it all comes to, I guess, to light because I've had a couple friends over the lifetime, and I can't believe it because when Mitch started this book a year and a half, on top of 10 years ago, I said, "What am I going to say?" He said, "Nothing. Just tell your life." I said, "You don't want to hear that." I said, "I'll keep the good for ourselves." Okay, he said, "All right, we'll do that." So anyways, he has. And as I said before, I had the pleasure of meeting the owner of this bookstore down on Lodo. Yeah, years ago, and they didn't know who I was until I got in there and said, this is you. Yeah, this is me, whatever you're talking about. But anyhow, it was a pleasure meeting them and meeting all my good friends because each and every one of you, I think I have a story to tell, and especially my good friend in front here, Margaret Potter. She was one of my guiding lights in a young life for me and my wife because she kept her husband halfway straight. As they say, he was crooked as he wanted to come, but I didn't know that until after he passed away. I said, "Oh," because I talked to his daughter one day, Eileen. And I said, "What a good man your father was." She said, "Look, don't bullshit me." Anyway, see, you never know until you get into the meat of the crux of everything that's going on. But like I said before, I'm very flattered that I've had the opportunity to speak with you because I'm not much at speaking. I think I'm a little better at conducting a band, a little small band, where I often tell the band leaders, "Well, look, this is like a true democracy, okay? Whatever I say goes, and that's the end." They look at me, "Oh, is that the way you feel?" "Yeah, that's me. I pay you. You play me." Okay, that's the name they give. And anyhow, I had a good time. And as I said before, there's so much I had to say because the book tells most of it in little explicit details, and you get a chance to see what I've been doing and all that sort of thing. I said before, like I said about my mother, she said about me talking. She said, "Look, son, I was very young." She says, "You know, you got a big mouth." I don't know if she's talking about. She says, "You talk too damn much." She says, "Don't ever talk unless you have something to say." So I was 40 years old before I knew that I could talk. I said, "Oh boy, thank you, Mom." So in other words, after that, I really haven't shut up. But life is taking its toll, and I'm glad to be on the train with it when it's going through the tunnels and so forth, you know. And as I was saying before, I know so many people here, I can't believe it. And if any of you have questions, ask me. Don't feel that you shy about it. Just come and ask me because I'll probably answer you wrong anyhow, and it won't matter. But right now, I'd like to turn it over to my able friend Mitch Hendelsman, and let him say a few words. He's a linguist, okay? He doesn't know it, but that's what he is. And I'm only the stooge, so Mr. Edelman, okay. Mitch.
Thank you. I want to acknowledge Sid Harriet, who was instrumental in getting this book published. We finished a manuscript 11 years ago, and it was Sid who was able to work some magic and finally get it published. So thank you, Sid. Charlie has played Carnegie Hall, but I consider it just as big an honor to play the tattered cover with Charlie as we do this. I just want to say a couple of things. The first time I met Charlie was performing live with him at KUVO. It was a fundraiser. And the first thing I saw was some cigar smoke wafting into the studio, and then a stool, and then a bass, and then Charlie came in. And it was the coolest thing in the world. And we played some gigs together. And then Charlie's cousin, Pernell Steen, said one day, you know, Charlie should write his memoirs. You know, he's, like, done some amazing things. And I was headed for a sabbatical to write another book and figured I'd have some free time. So I just said, well, I'll help. And that's the way this whole thing got started. This book is Charlie's autobiography. None of the words in here are mine. Okay, I organized some sections and, you know, edited and things like that, but it's all Charlie's. Unless you find a word or two that's not good, then they're mine. Okay. So Pernell suggested that Charlie do his memoirs, and I said I'd help. And so Charlie and I had breakfast one morning at the Le Peep up on York Street. And I was a bit intimidated. So what I did when I'm usually intimidated, what I do when I'm usually intimidated is to say a bad joke. So I said, Charlie, I said, I don't know if you know this, but I'm a white guy. Am I the person to do this with you? And he said, you're the only one who could do this. And that was amazingly charming and gracious and put me at ease. And what we decided was I go over his house with my new little tape recorder, compliments of the University of Colorado, who gave me a little bit of money. So I went and bought a transcribing machine. This was before dictation apps, okay, back in the old days. And I was going to go over his house every Tuesday morning and have him tell his stories. Well, the first week I show up, cigar smoke. Get out of the way. I say, Charlie, you're ready? He says, I'm not taping today. I just want to talk. I said, okay, what am I going to do? All right. And that happened for 2 weeks. And I realized two things were happening. One, this guy's a musician. He's rehearsing. And two, he's auditioning me. And so one of the things that I decided early on was not to ask any questions during those taping sessions. Because what I wanted to do was create or recreate what it would be like to sit in Charlie's living room and listen to him tell his stories. And if I would ask questions, then the book would be a little bit about what I thought it should be about, and I didn't want to do that. So Charlie talked. He was over 40 years old at this point, so he was talking. And
I was 65 then, tell the truth, Ruth.
65 plus a little bit, so...
Yeah, a little bit.
we'll get the math right at some point.
Yeah.
But
while he rests for a second, I'll tell you that it took us almost 2 years to write this damn thing. Every week we were together for at least 4 hours on one day in the month. No, in the week. And I laughed. I said, oh, boy. But I went through, I think, I counted 50 boxes of cigars in that time. And by the way, you might be thrilled to know that I quit smoking 2 months ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't feel any better, but I quit smoking. I asked my doctor, says, hey, doc, what do you think about my smoking? He says, what do you mean, what I think about your smoking? He says, you haven't thought about it, have you? I says, no. He says, well, I won't think about it either. Goodbye. And that was that end of that. Anyhow, Mitch has been my very dearest friend, besides being the one who wrote this book and also a very excellent trumpet player, because that's how I first met him. He played, he thought he was not good, but I said, no, you're all right, baby, play. And he did, and I had to laugh because Pernell Singh, who was my blood cousin, ushered him up and had him play. And I said, well, look, Pernell, where'd you get this man? He said, oh, he's only a psychology professor. I said, only? My God, what are you talking about? And so we had a friendship that lasted from there and on down through. And like I tell people, we're related because this is my bros, B-R-O, as they say, bro, B-R-O. Okay, we don't look alike, but this is my bro. And I'll be eternally grateful to him for what he has contributed in terms of putting the record straight for so many people about what I did and what I didn't do. But thank all of you again, and here's Mitch back to tell you some more about this.
All the people who've read the book so far, both of them have said that reading the book is like sitting with Charlie. And so that to me says that I did what I set out to do, and that is to be invisible in the book. While I was transcribing and editing, I made some decisions about what would go in and what wouldn't, and basically the stuff that stayed in was stuff that moved the action, right? Moved the plot, and stuff that moved me. Just things that I knew had to be in there. There's another book to be written, the X-rated version of this, of course, but that'll come at some point. But we did this, we finished it 11 years ago, and we, for 10 of those years, people were saying, so how's that book with Charlie coming along? And I said, well, it's, you know, it's still there. It's a book. And it took Sid to get us cracking. But I'm just really glad that it exists. Now, I want to just read some stuff for you. Okay, you got a minute? Bless you. This stuff is nothing to sneeze at. This is okay. Sorry. It's okay. All right. And again, these are Charlie's words. I will not do my Charlie Burrell impression. Okay, my voice isn't that deep. Or is it sonorous? Sonorous? Resonant.
Is it raspy, you mean?
Raspy. Maybe that's it. Charlie had 50 cases of cigars during those couple of years that we worked, and I had laundry bills because every time I went home, I just felt like a big cigar. It was great. All right, here it is from the prologue. When I was in the seventh grade, one Friday afternoon, ready to get out for that two-day vacation, you know, Mr. Harrington, who was the music teacher, came in at 2:30 and said they had an opening for musicians and who wanted to come in. And no one raised their hand except me. And I raised my hand and went into the room there. He looked into the corner and says, well, Charlie, all we have left here is a bass fiddle. He called it a bass fiddle, okay? A big aluminum bass fiddle. I said, I'll take it. And I started right then. I hauled it home on the first day, Monday. And Mom said, I think maybe we need something to haul that in. So I got a little red wagon. She bought it for 25 cents from Goodwill. And I started hauling the bass in that wagon every day, to and from school. And the kids looked at me like I was crazy. I didn't care, you know? I started right off the bat just liking the bass tremendously. So every day I would practice an hour, 2 hours. And my mother used to look at me. In the interim, I had heard on our crystal set radio, which a lot of people don't know about nowadays, but it was one of the first homemade sets. I heard this phenomenal sound of an orchestra on it. I finally found something, and I discovered it was the San Francisco Symphony. And the conductor was Pierre Monteau. And I didn't even know how to pronounce it in those days. But I told my mother, I said, hey, Mom, I'd like to perform with the San Francisco Symphony. And she was smart beyond her years. She didn't look down her nose. She said, well, son, you can do anything you want to do. Just be honest to your cause and do it every day of your life. Let nothing get in your way. Let's see. I'm going to go. I'm going to take a risk that you're going to have some good questions. So I'm going to skip a couple things. My father was a scoundrel, and he used to get the three boys up in the morning. We were only about maybe 8, 9, and 10. He would get us up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go out and hustle. That's the word they used instead of steal. Hustle coal from the railroad tracks so we'd have fuel for our coal stove. We had an old potbelly coal stove, which was outlandish. It had cracks all over the place. We would go on the railroad track every morning at 4 o'clock. We were about a block and a half from the railroad track. We had a good time, but it was also dangerous. Excuse me. What we would do is wait for a slow freight train to come through with coal cars on it, and we'd walk down 2 or 3 blocks below where we wanted to get off and stack coal on the side. And when we got near our home, where we wanted to get off, we'd kick the coal off. The big thing that helped me get out of coal stealing was the fact that I got greedy, okay? One evening, it was getting good, and Joe was picking up pieces of coal. Now, he was pretty strong. He would carry 2 bushels of coal on his back, and I could only carry one. He later suffered from that. It was one of those debilitating things that happens to you later in life because of what you did before in life. Anyhow, we picked up this coal, and I picked up a lump of coal, which was a pretty big-sized lump, and I looked over, and I saw another lump, which was even bigger. When I reached over and grabbed that big lump of coal, I smashed my finger, my index finger, right hand, audiovisual.
Audiovisual. Well, you know, while he's resting for a second, I'll tell you about that. Hold on. After I smashed my finger, I went home, and I always had money stashed. Like Mom says, always have some money stashed in case you need it for an emergency. And I had, I think, 25 cents or something stashed. So I got the 25 cents, and I went and got on the streetcar, which in those days was 5 cents. Went all the way downtown with my finger screwed up to the receiving hospital. Went in and got on the table. And in those days, they were not very comfortable with Negroes anyhow. So they'd look at you and say, oh, you're all right. So in the house, he got me on the table and he said, I'll tell you what, turn your head. And he says, when I pluck you with, touch this, if you can't feel him, we'll have to amputate. So I was smart, being from the ghetto, obviously. And I turned my head, and I was looking on the side there, and he touched, I said, oh, I wasn't feeling a damn thing, you know. And he touched it again, oh. He said, well, I guess it'll be okay. So it took me 2 years of working with that finger to make it a real finger. And it turned to be one of the, as the Houston boys used to say, the fastest fingers in the East. Because I could pizzicato so fast, you know, they couldn't believe it. I said, well, what happened? I said, I don't know, freak nature, but that's where my, and I still have it, and it has never bothered me. And I've been fortunate enough to not to have any arthritis at all, only in my head, and that doesn't matter. But, and as I said before, that finger is the cause of what happened and taught me a severe lesson, you know, not to be too damn greedy in life.
That was like word for word what you wrote.
Yeah.
That was wonderful. That was good. I was following along while you were saying that.
Oh, that's what I like. That's why I keep him around, because I don't know what the hell I'm saying anyhow. And it seems like he does. So go ahead, Mitch.
More from chapter 8, if you're following along. When I got good enough, which was in the 10th grade, every Saturday I went to what they called All City High School Orchestra. We had private lessons from the people who were in the Detroit Symphony. There were at least 13 to 15 of the musicians from the Detroit Symphony who were teachers there. And mine happened to be the principal bass player, Gaston Brohan. And I got a lesson every week. Every Friday, we had a free lesson. All the bass players were white except me. And he told me when I first started studying with him that he would teach me conditionally. What was this condition routine, you know? He said, if you don't try to play the classics, I'll teach you. Do you want to tell him what you told Johan?
Yeah, I looked at him with my raised eye, and I said to myself, now here's some shit he's laying on me. I'll lay it back on him. And I turned around, and in those days you had to use some unusual language. I said, listen, Mr. Casson, I think I agree with what you're saying, and I'm not going to try to play the classics. I just want to play jazz. And he looked at me and said, all right, and he took went from there, but I did fool him.
I want to present now, if any movie producers are in the audience, I want to present the dramatic arc, the beginning of what could be the movie version of this. Okay, I'm thinking Cuba Gooding Jr., Don Cheadle, you know, Denzel, I don't know. And that's just for me. You know, I don't know who to play him. Okay. Billy Horner, my friend who played trumpet, was one of the real mentors in my early days in music because he had education, lessons, and so forth, long before I even got in the field. He was the first Negro that really broke the barrier to be accepted, actually, into the white man's world of the classics. Actually, Billy, indirectly, had a big influence on me getting my job with the Denver Symphony 10 years later. Billy was 17 or 18 years old when he was chosen to go abroad with the Leopold Stokowski All Youth Orchestra. And the fellow who chose him was Saul Kasten, the principal trumpeter in Philadelphia in those days, under Stokowski. Kasten auditioned Billy, and he made it possible so that Billy could be accepted. And Billy was accepted, but he never went abroad with the orchestra. They were getting ready to go on their state tour overseas, and they called Billy and told him he couldn't go because he was black. The only reason they couldn't do it was because of race.
And in relationship to that, Billy, being my good friend, I didn't know for years that his father was a hypocrite. And when I say hypocrite, I mean the fact that he used to call me Senior Garbage Face. I thought it was a compliment, you know. And 20 years later, Billy said, didn't you know what my old man was doing? He was putting you down. I said, oh, is that what he was doing? I said, okay, well. He didn't succeed, so it didn't matter to me. But anyhow, Sir Senior Garbage Face, because he was light and had what they call good hair, and I was a darker and had kinky hair. So in other words, hey, that's what he called me that. And I lived that down. It didn't matter. But as I said before, I've had a good ride, and I wouldn't trade it for anything in the world. Mitch.
Okay. I'm going to get Charlie into the Navy again. Here's what he said. And again, just a little glimpse of Charlie. The war came along. They were enlisting then for the service, and you had to go. So when it came my turn, before they drafted me, I said, well, I think I'd like to see if I can't beat this rap of getting in the Army. So I went down and I applied to get in the U.S. Navy. At that time, they had no blacks in the Navy except cooks, okay? I knew what the routine was, so they put me on hold. And I came back two or three times to see if I could get in. Finally, I did manage to get in the service, and I was glad because what drove me to that was this. I had a half a dozen parking violations, tickets. And the fuzz, do you want to pronounce that more correctly?
As they say in the vernacular, fuzz.
Okay. The police were out looking for me, okay, and I got the word. The night before I joined the Navy, the police came there at my apartment, which me and my brother lived in, and he saw them out the front door and told me, and I jumped out the side window and went over and hid until the next morning. When the recruiting office opened, I went down and they accepted me, and I signed my name, and I was automatically in the U.S. Navy. When I came back, the detectives picked me up on the street and took me down to the station. They were going to arrest me and so forth and such. And I realized that they couldn't arrest a serviceman. And I told them, I said, I'm now a serviceman. I'll never forget, one of them looked at me and said, oh, shit.
Oh, he said more than that, but we put that off the book print.
Yeah, it's PG. Oh, the book is PG.
He cussed me like a sailor would cuss, you know. I never heard such cursing in my life because I had fouled him up in what he wanted to do. But I got around that easily. Whew.
Charlie talks about moving to Denver, and then he says this. One cold morning in the winter, I guess there are cold mornings other than that, but We set the stage. One cold morning in the winter, I was on the streetcar, which had a pot-bellied stove at each end for heat. I saw this fella get on with an unusual-looking case, which looked like a pool cue case, but I knew what it was, a bass case for the bow. And I asked the fella, I said, "Pardon me, but I see you have, is that a bass bow case?" "Yeah, such and such and such." We struck up a conversation, and he said, "I'm John Van Buskirk." And I said, "I'm Charlie Burrell," you know, blah, blah, blah. And he said, "Incidentally, you know, I'm the principal bass player with the symphony." I said, "Really?" You know? So I told him what my aspirations and inspirations were, and I asked him if I could come over and study with him. He says, "Sure." He lived out on Tamarack, right north of Colfax, out in Aurora. So I used to go out there to have lessons. And after three or four lessons, he asked me if I would be interested in playing with the Denver Symphony. And I said, and I thought, "My God, yes. That's why I've been doing this practicing for 18 years, you know?" I said, "Sure, you know?" Anyhow, he arranged the audition with Mr. Saul Kasten. He was the principal trumpet with Leopold Stokowski in the Philadelphia Orchestra for 35 years, and he was without a doubt the most renowned trumpet player of the day. He had taken over the Denver Symphony in about 1946 or 47.
Oh, and in addition to that, speaking of this gentleman named Billy Horner, I also played at a tuba. And as a matter of fact, I got so good, they tell me that they wanted to accept me in one of the big conservatories. But I said to myself, "I don't think so." I said, "I'm sick with Mom because she needs me more so." But anyhow, that one thing led to another. And so I finally made it to Saul Kasten. And and Billy Horner's teacher, whose name was Otto Kurt Smizer, had one of the most beautiful sounds I had ever heard on the trumpet in my life. And I used to get lessons from him by cutting his grass, washing his windows, doing a lot of jobs, and he would give me a lesson on the tuba. So that's how I got to learn how to play tuba pretty good. So in other words, that's just a little addition which was not couldn't be put in the books, but that's a little of what happened on that saga.
I remember my first day coming into rehearsal. Oh, yes. And I had to laugh because Saul Kasten came up and says, "Look, ladies and gentlemen, we have the pleasure, proud pleasure, of having in our midst someone who has done such and such and such." And I wondered who the hell he's talking about, you know? Then he said, "Mr. Burrell is our newest acquisition." I almost had a movement. I was shaken. I was shaken like a leaf for a second there. I graciously said, "Thank you," and all that sort of thing.
Oh, boy. There was so much that went on, though, in those days that I really couldn't express it in the book. But to Mitch, I could tell him a lot more. And I'm going to tell you that there was much more to be said and done about the little things that happened during that period of getting in first in the orchestra. It was not all honey strawberries, yeah, and all that stuff, you know.
Here's a paragraph I want to read to you because it encapsulates the ethic of this guy. The symphony had only about a 12 to 14 week season in those days. Consequently, I had to get something else to augment, and I applied down at the city auditorium for a job as a janitor. And a wonderful fellow named Tom Seymour was the manager of the auditoriums down there. He was very understanding and sympathetic with what I was doing and appreciated it, you know. And he was like a real influence and father figure to me because he would allow me the flexibility of being a janitor and a stagehand while playing with the symphony. What I would do is get down there normally at 6 in the morning at the auditorium and practice until 8 o'clock and work as a stagehand from 8 till 9:30 and then go for the rehearsal, which was right there for the symphony, from 9:30 to 12 and come back at 12:30 and work as a janitor till 3 or 3:30. And I look back today and I realize that some of my greatest friends over the years were stagehands. And then, of course, after the performance, he went down to the clubs, like down where Annie's is now on Colfax. That was, I think, the Bandbox.
Band, yeah.
And after the symphony, he would play the clubs around town.
Well, there's so much to say, as I said before, because every little thing that someone asks me, I have to elaborate on and tell them the truth. Like Mom said, always tell the truth, son. And I did, only up to a point, though. And by the way, I'd like to say that in reference to what happened to me when I first came to Denver and got established and so forth, I met good people, marvelous people, and I had a couple of little students. And it used to tickle me because I thought that was the best thing in the world that happened to me, to have students. I couldn't believe it, you know. And so I had, I'll tell you this close because it's not in the book, but one of my good students was Dr. Robbie over here, who is now a dentist. He was one of my base students, and he's so damn good that after a month, I had to tell him, look, I'm cutting you loose because I don't want to be in competition with you. You're too damn good. Get out of my office. Dr. Robbie, okay? And all these things happened and said before. I didn't hear that. Oh, it always is thick. That's what makes it so nice and comfortable, you know. Yeah, definitely. Carry on, Mitch.
All right. I got two more things to read to you. One is a paragraph to just capture some of Charlie's jazz experience. One of the most memorable moments in my life was when one night, after hours, the great Charlie Parker came up on the stand. And everyone was so excited that Charlie Parker, Bird, was there. And he was going to come up and play. Well, I had to laugh because Bird came up and sat in the chair in the front of the bandstand and went dead asleep for 2 hours. That was the only Bird I ever heard, you know, which was nothing. That was the closest I ever got to playing with Charlie Parker.
I know when people used to ask me, how did it feel to play with Charlie Parker? I said, I really don't know. And I tell them, they said, you mean he slept? He had a little habit called dope, okay? So in other words, he just sat in the chair up in front of them and went to sleep, not only for 2 hours, but for 3 hours while we played, took intermissions, came back and played. Charlie Parker was still sitting there. I think about 8 o'clock that morning, he got up and got his fix and left. And that's what was my association with Charlie Parker, Bird.
There's a story I'm not going to read. You'll read it in the book about Billie Holiday, which was a little bit more active. You know, I teach, and I have students all the time who say, I got to graduate in 4 years. And I say, like, why? You know, they're 19 years old. I have this suit, I think, is 19 years old. And they're so impatient, you know. And so when I think about taking the long view, I think about this paragraph. Since I was 12 years old and first heard the San Francisco Symphony on our homemade crystal radio set, my ambition was to play with the San Francisco Symphony and to play under Pierre Manteau, who was one of the greatest French conductors of that time. That was my ambition when I was 12 years old, and by the time I got to be 40 in San Francisco, 28 years later, I had the thrill, pleasure, and everything else of playing under the illustrious Pierre Manteau for 2 weeks. He was a guest conductor emeritus. He came and conducted, and I called my mom and told her, Mom, I've arrived. My ambition has been realized in life. I've played under Pierre Manteau. And that was it.
And in that same period, I had the pleasure of playing under a magnificent guitarist whose name was Segovia. A lot of you will know Segovia. One of the world's greatest guitar players in the world. I had the pleasure of playing on stage with him, and after that I thought, well, look, what can I do now? You know, I sit on my ass and relax now. So, but I didn't, and things got even better because the principal bass player, whose name was Phil Karp, used to take me out on a boat, what we call Annie's, Annie's boat, tugboat, on the river, and we'd have lunch from 11 o'clock to 4, and he weighed 295 pounds. He was about almost 6'9", and here I was. We'd eat all that time and have a good time, and that was a part of my education, too.
So now, given Charlie's example, I can tell my students to give it 28 years, see what happens. And I also now have taken to having lunches from 11 to 4 every day. So, boy, thanks, Charlie.
Boy, that food was so good. I look back now and I can lick my chops and say, boy, that was some food. You couldn't beat it, and especially in San Francisco where you had the good ocean food, you know. And my favorite, obviously, was oysters. We used to eat about 2 dozen oysters apiece. Now, this is just 2 people, okay? Our oysters apiece. Of course, we were crazy in those days, crazy, but we enjoyed every second of it.
I think it's time to throw this open for questions. And so if you have a question, let us know. I'm going to repeat it so we can hear it on the podcast, and then we'll do our best to avoid it or address it, whatever we want. Question is, when you went in the Navy, did they make you a cook?
No. They weren't that nice. I never forget, when I went in the Navy, there was no place for Negroes, no touring, and no camp. That's what it was, because all they had was a big camp on the main side, they call it, which is 40 miles up from Chicago, and they had to truck all of us in by truck across the road, 3 miles down the road, and in a dirt road, and everything was dirt, and there was no camp there. We had to sleep in tents for the first 2 or 3 nights while they started building a camp called Robert Small, and from that we survived, okay.
And at that camp was a trumpet player named Clark Terry.
Yeah, most of you know Clark Terry very well, I'm sure. Well, a little story about Clark Terry. Now, he was one of my very dearest friends because we used to both rehearse in what we would call the Navy washroom. And the Navy washroom, if you can visual it, was a big, long room with 2 or 3 troughs that led down there where you wash your, what you call your whites, your white uniforms and so forth. And on one end of this washroom, Clark Terry would be practicing with his mute, the mute in his horn, and I would be on the other end with the mute on my bass, practicing for hours. And kids used to come out and say, "What are you jive son of bitches doing?" You know, that's just the way they said, "What are you jive son of bitches doing?" You know, "Where are you going? You won't need that." And but by and large, we were the only two that survived and became really not infamous, but famous. So that was part of that game.
Other questions?
Yeah. Do you think that if that teacher, when you were taught, had a different instrument available, do you think you would have played that instrument as well?
If I don't think it mattered what it was. It was an instrument, and I didn't know it in those days, but it took me years to realize that that was my ticket out of the ghetto. And my mother said that's the way to get out, by education, and education meant studying so that I could be in competition with everyone else and make it possible. But I had a good time getting it there.
Ooh, this is the story about going to New York for deli sandwiches.
Oh, yeah. Yes. I think I always love to eat good food, especially. That's why I had marvelous women. Thank you. And so this thing about food was every time I go to New York, I go to a place called the Deli, Carnegie Deli, and get me a sandwich. What do they call those sandwiches?
Hoagies?
No. Corned beef, thank you. I'm getting a little old here. Give me a corned beef sandwich, and every time I go there now, then I would pick up from Denver 2 or 3 sandwiches and come back to Denver. And that was about the size of what that meant for me. Oh, and by the way, a little bit about the time that I worked for Continental Airlines. A lot of you didn't know that. It's in the book, but I don't think you knew how marvelous it was. I worked for Continental Airlines for 5 years and had a marvelous time because I made so much money. It was outrageous. And you very, very seldom have a musician say he made money. But we were slinging bags. We used to make as much as $150 a day in tips, which you did not have to declare. And that was my big opening into the real world of reality. And by the way, the fellow who is the assistant to the whole Colorado Bull, not the Colorado, but the airlines, was, you remember hearing about Robert Six or something? Big Six? Or his, a man was named Kelly, and he was assistant. So Kelly's wife was on the board of directors for the symphony, and so I got all kind of concessions, and I had a marvelous time getting through there. And I stayed there for 5 years until Uncle Sam said they were going to start taxing, taking money out off of us for because we made too much money, and I quit.
Well, now I know what I'm going to say when people say, have you ever played Carnegie Hall? I'm going to say, no, but I hope to get to Carnegie Deli one of these days. That'd be great. Sandwiches sound good.
Speaking of food, I'd like to thank you for cooking such good gumbo one night. And I would like you to choose one of these two stories to tell us, either about the night that another bass player got propelled across a row of bass trunks, or the night that Latimer Gulschmann tore up the score for the great C major.
They're both exciting. Oh, wait a minute. Well, one was, what was the first one again?
The first one was the night that a certain bass player got propelled across a row of bass trunks.
Oh, yes, that was my doing. Yeah, his name was Jimmy Carroll, and he was a good bass player, but he thought so too, and that made a difference. And he fell under the wings of the man who was in charge of the business manager, and they got kind of tight. So they're going to tell me what to do and what not to do, you know. And I said to Jimmy, I said, look, son, because I was 20 years older than him, I said, look, son, you don't do that, you know. I mean, I'll play this thing, but don't get in my crawl because I'm doing the best I can with what I have. And he looked at me and he said something I never forget. But anyhow, the famous words when he said that, I grabbed him, not bragging, but I didn't hit him. I just grabbed him by the collar and drug him across the room, down, all down through the trunks and so forth, and gave him the lesson of his life. And we've been friends ever since. Very, very, very dear friends ever since. And what else did you ask me about? Latimer Gulschmann was a crazy man. I mean, we used to call him the old gimp because he would limp. You know, he was the former conductor of the St. Louis Symphony for years, a very good conductor in what he did conduct, but what he didn't know, he couldn't conduct from a hill of beans. So in other words, he was that way, but he was had a wonderful disposition toward women. He hated them, you know. And so when he found out that me and my wife were married, I think it kind of hit him. He couldn't stand for it. So he used to get my wife and give her the business, you know, tease her and all that sort of thing. And so finally, I had to laugh because Harry Safstrom, who was the manager then, he was on pins and needles, and I didn't know this until later. They said Harry was sweating like a mule because he didn't know whether I was going to hit Gulschmann or not. And I said, no, I know better than that, you know. But anyhow, that it worked out to the fact that he became my friend because when he got close to me, he realized that I was only a person, and he loved jazz. So we used to play once a season up in Durango at the old Strader Hotel. And there was a bar on the corner called, I forget what the name of it was, but anyhow, we played there. And the symphony went there with Gulschmann. He played there, and I have never seen a man shake so much in his life. He got up and danced. The conductor. I said, what is this crap, you know? Old Gimp got up and he shook his thing, you know. I said, oh boy. And from then on, I could do no wrong. I was number one in his book, so that was the episode with him, which I couldn't tell in the book, but that was what happened with that little episode. There were dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of episodes that didn't mean a thing to me because I just brushed him aside and went on and did what I had to do for practice. And by the way, talking about getting up and going down to the auditorium and practicing at 6 o'clock, it wasn't 6 o'clock, it was 4 o'clock in the morning. So I'd practice for at least 4 hours before anything started, and then my day would start from there. Oh, yes. What made him so mad is we were playing a certain composition, which was a very nice composition, and I never forget. He didn't want to go out to the small towns anyhow, because he called it the hinterlands, okay? And that was a thing that I got it stuck in his craw because he couldn't stand it. Anyhow, we were right outside of Denver here, and as a matter of fact, up the streetways there, and we were playing a little selection called Anitra's Dance, I think it was, you know, a little waltz which goes like da 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 boom boom. Then we're on long nights. And he got, pardon me, pissed off because he wanted to play a little faster. And he looked at the concertmaster who was a violinist, forget his name, and he looked at me and said, oh, I can conduct faster than you can play. So he started conducting a little faster. And the concertmaster I never saw him angry before, but he got really perturbed. And he got up, and the business manager had to restrain him to keep him from killing the conductor. Okay? One of those little things that happens here and there.
Go
ahead.
The question is about Miles Davis and whether he spent time in Denver and whether you interacted with him.
Me now? Oh, you want to know about me and Miles? I didn't know Miles Davis, thank God. I respected his playing, but I never respected him as a gentleman because he had a big habit called junkie, okay? And he treated women like they were dogs. And I always respected his playing, but I never had dissociation with him, and I was blessed because that was a real blessing.
In Miles Davis's autobiography, he mentions that he thought about going up to Great Lakes and join that Navy band because he heard it was really good. He also thought about studying classics. He got into Juilliard and he wanted to study the classics, but he gave up on it. He said, nobody's going to hire a black, you know what, in the symphony.
Why do you think Mr. Brohan only agreed to teach you if you didn't want to learn the classics?
Why do you think Mr. Brohan agreed to teach you if you only wanted to, if you didn't want to do the classics?
It's simple. Race. I mean, he was German, and he was a real white redneck. I mean, from the shoes on up, you know, he never changed. But I can say one thing for him: he did give the world the best bass rosin that has ever been produced. See, I'm honest. It's called oak rosin, and I had that my entire career, my entire 60 or 70 years of playing, I had oak rosin, and I just got rid of the last bit, I think, 2 or 3 months ago, and I gave it to a little bass player who's now down at Dazzle. His name is Fred Fuller. So that was his contribution, but he just was a real racist personified, you know. As a matter of fact, speaking of that, yeah, I might as well tell you the rest of the story. we.
This, we're going to retitle this Volume 1.
You better do it soon. And then Mother Nature is talking to me, and I might have to answer the call, but that's all right. I don't mind. You only come this way one time, you might as well enjoy it. And if you don't, you can forget it, you know. But anyhow, what was that thing you asked me the last one? See what I mean? When you get a little older, when you get over 40. Shame on you. So in other words, there's so much that I had to tell you about it, I couldn't begin to tell you. Oh, and by the way, about the Rossonian, you know, a lot of you know where the Rossonian is and was. That was an epic thing of my life, where I got my threshold and foot into playing real jazz with a lady named Nellie Lutcher. A lot of you don't know who she was, but she was a swinger, as they say, back in those days. And she had one of the most important records put out back in the early 50s that ever was put out. It was called He's Got a Fine Brown Frame. And she used to do that back in the 50s. And I had the pleasure, after she had performed at the Rossonian, of joining her, because her bass player, who was a marvelous bass player, and I make no bones, I wasn't half the bass player that he was. His name was, what was his name, do you remember?
Al McKibben?
No, that was my other teacher. Anyhow, this fellow was a magnificent bass player. Hold on, hold your breath.
Mel Hinton?
No.
Ray Brown?
Not that, go on. Anyhow, he was one of the best, fine bass players. He was the bass player with Lena Horne for 10 years or 15 years, okay? And his grandmother got sick in New York. He had to drive back to New York, and they came to me. The owner of the Rossonian came to me and asked me if I could fill his shoes. I said, I don't think so. So he said, we'll try. I said, okay. So I went in and started and did play for on that engagement. And after that, she liked me so well, not because I could play well, but of course I was a gentleman, I guess, and had no habits. The only habit I had was living, but I loved that. So in other words, that's when I joined Nellie Lutcher for, I think, 4 years of the summertime, because in those years, the symphony was not enough to pay, and you had an option whether you wanted to play the summer season or not, and I chose not to play it rather than playing with Nellie Lutcher, where I made big money and was treated like a gentleman. As a matter of fact, we got over to Hawaii and brought there by most of you know this name, Doris Duke Cromwell. She was our sponsor. And Nellie didn't like to fly, so she had to go on a train. So they flew me out to Hawaii. But anyhow, on the way back, it was just the opposite. I came back to the States, and then from there I got what we call the Pullman car. It was not the coach; it was a big suite. Charlie in the suite. Can you imagine that? You know. And I had a chance to practice my butt off, okay, and ate well and had a marvelous time. That was my... Oh, by the way, speaking of the Rossonian, the fellow's name who was the proprietor there, his name was... the mind is going. Thank you. Anyhow, the proprietor there was... And he was a nice guy to a point, but he was crazy. He brought all the jazz musicians in town, and when that little episode happened, and someone said, well, who are you going to get? And then he told them all, I said, now, see, they keep this among us, okay? I don't want to get this to get out any further. If it does, I didn't say it. They say, who are you going to get to play bass? And he looks at him, and I heard him. He says, oh, you didn't know that... Charlie Burrell is my main nigger. on the base. That's what he said, okay? But I was smart. I always got my money up in front from him. I never let him get the upper hand on me, so that was very select thing that happened in my life, okay? He didn't stop me. I just laughed at it and went on and had me another pig ear sandwich cracked up. A pig ear sandwich and a little cognac and my cigar and my wife's. Oh, yeah, I was in Seventh Heaven, you know. I didn't have to worry about it.
The bass player you were thinking about before is George DeVivier, right?
Yes, George DeVivier. A lot of you have heard of him. The very finest, one of the finest bass players ever lived, George DeVivier. He was with Lena Horne, I said, for 10, 15 years. And he was a very excellent bass player. And if I could play half as well as he played, I'd consider myself a bass player. But I'm not that crazy. I'm no better. So,
I think let's do one more question.
I'm a drummer, so I'm just curious if you could tell us maybe one or two of your all-time favorite drummers to play with.
Favorite drummers to play with.
Favorite drummers. Well, my favorite drummer was Gus Johnson, who played with Ralph Sutton for years and years and years. And the reason was because he had a good sense of humor. He could swing. And he was a nice, just an all-around nice guy, okay? And as a matter of fact, I'm glad you spoke of drummers because normally the drummers and the bass players have a certain correlation, okay? They're like brothers. Now, if they're not like brothers, they don't play together. And I guess one of the best drummers I ever played with before that was named, his name was Lee Arellano, Chicano. Yeah, a lot of you remember him from the Playboy. And he was one of the best, finest drummers I ever played with. I loved every second of what he was doing, you know. So that was it.
So before we get to the signing portion, I just want to say thank you so much for coming out. It's been a blast for me. It's been a blast for the last 14 years. And I also just want to remind you that there's 167 shopping days till Christmas, you know, and whatever it is. Do you have any parting words?
No, like I said before, I enjoyed people. That's my thing. My big thing in life is people. I love to see people. And there's nothing more gracious to me than people. All ages, size, shapes, religions, and everything else. And I've never been a pig about religion because there's only one thing, one man, and that's it for all of us. So we take it for there and go and do the best we can with what we have, and that's about it. But I want to thank each and every one of you that said before, because you're my relatives, okay? Each and every one of you, thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.